I've had a lot of arguments over the years about this one, and I think it's something that gets demonized a lot in climbing, but I think there is a balance and there's an argument for both sides of it.
Hi there, welcome to another episode of Ask Lattice, and you'll see again that you have myself, Ella, and Ollie, and we decided we'd kick Tom off for a little bit longer because we thought we got a good rapport going, so hope you don't mind. And we've got a number of questions that you have put in to cover today, and the first one is a really interesting one, and it's quite a controversial topic sometimes, isn't it? And I know Ollie has got a lot to say on it, so I'll let him give some thoughts first. So the topic is all around how much muscle mass you have versus the performance that you want to achieve in climbing and how to get that balance.
Yeah, this one's something I'm quite a passionate arguer about. I've had a lot of arguments over the years about this one, and I think it's something that gets demonized a lot in climbing, but I think there is a balance and there's an argument for both sides of it. So first of all, climbing is obviously a weight-based sport in many ways, so power to weight ratio plays a large role. Having come from a strength and conditioning background, I always found it really interesting working with other S&C coaches or people during studies where their entire performance and career, they add in hypertrophy phases into their training, and they're looking on muscle mass and trying to increase strength and power through muscle mass size. And every time we'd do a comparison and I would say, actually, I'm trying to stay the same weight, or oh, I've dropped a bit of weight for performance, or I'm staying the same weight, or I'm increasing only slightly, but not trying to put too much muscle mass on, they'd always find it really shocking. However, this was the more and more I've learned about it and worked with so many different clients over the years, I've just seen even how my own thoughts were kind of quite skewed in that way. So muscle mass, first of all, is going to play a big role in the amount of force you can produce. And I think in terms of the weight that you put on based on muscle mass, it's got to come down to you as an individual. So for a lot of guys that find it quite easy to put muscle on, adding in hypertrophy phases probably isn't going to be something that you need to do. The amount of muscle you'll put on to accomplish your goals will probably get put on naturally through doing the movements of climbing yourself. So a good example of that is if you look at gymnasts, they put on usually around 1 kilo to 2 kilos a year from a very young age in muscle mass. And they're all really, really quite bulky guys and they're really strong. But actually when you look at them and you look at their weights, they are quite light and they're quite small and they're quite petite. It's just because you're seeing them during movements where effectively they can see all the muscles working and it looks like they're more muscular than they are. So doing that exercise, which is far more in body intense than climbing, has produced that muscle itself. They haven't been trying to add muscle to their, or hypertrophy training to their own normal gymnastic performances. So in climbing, I'd say if you're a guy who finds it easy to put muscle on, I would probably do that. Just focus on climbing itself and doing the regular training around that. Now, if you're a lot lighter in build, or if you're a female athlete that would struggle to put on muscle mass as well, I think it's a slightly different story, isn't it? And I think particularly your opinion on that in terms of female climbers is the same in terms of it's not actually that bad of a thing.
Yeah, and I think body image comes into that as well. And, you know, being really mindful with yourself in terms of, am I worried about putting muscle mass on because of the way I will look? Versus actually, is this going to help me in my performance? So if, for example, you feel as though you need to be a notch stronger and you need, as a female athlete or perhaps even a relatively lean, light, small framed male, and you struggle with those thuggy, burly moves that require those bigger muscle groups, then actually it might well be worth putting on a bit of muscle mass just to help you from a performance perspective. And also I think from the athletes who menstruate perspective, we all know and we all should know that having a regular menstrual cycle matters. And if we don't, it may be a sign that we do actually need to put some muscle mass on and we need to feed ourselves better, etc. And so actually, if you think about it from a perspective of if I'm not menstruating and I actually don't have much mass, then that might be an indicator that some things need to change in your lifestyle as well.
Yeah, I think that body image thing is quite important, and this is across all climbers. I mean, we were reading a study about swimmers, as some of the groups have the best body image satisfaction. And when you think about why that is, it's because they're going to be surrounded by people with a similar shape. And you might think that externally, because it's a very specific shape, tends to be a lot broader. And this is like in female swimmers, it might not be stereotypically what you think that people would be aiming for. But when you're thinking about your performance and you're surrounded by that same body image, it becomes more normalized. And I think in climbing, we've normalized overly skinny and focus on how much we weigh and how being light muscle mass is a key thing. And that's become normalized rather than think actually what is normal for other sports and the general population. So like I was saying before, if you are doing the activity itself and you are putting on that muscle mass, it probably means that you need to do that to accomplish the movements you're doing. I mean, yes, you can think about your movement efficiency. That is an important role. And you don't always want to just be focused on getting more stronger and producing more force. But if you are putting on extra muscle mass, it probably means that you need to. Now, as Ella said, if you're a female athlete or lighter male, if you're trying to do any sort of training which could produce muscle mass and you're worried about it, one of the things I always say to anyone I work with is, if it was that easy to put on muscle, every guy in the gym would be absolutely massive. It's not that easy to put on muscle and get everything absolutely right. You need to be in quite a lot of energy surplus, and you need to be doing the right type of training consistently for quite a period in order to put on that muscle itself. So don't be worried that you're going to wake up one day and just having put on 5 kilos of muscle. It's not that simple. So I guess on this is, muscle mass generally is a good thing. If you find it really easy to put on a lot quickly, focus on training which isn't going to help that. So don't do hypertrophy, but again, don't worry about putting on a couple of kilos. And if you don't find it naturally, it's that easy for you to put on muscle mass, then don't worry about it whatsoever. And sometimes it's actually really useful to focus on it for short periods, like in any other sport, because you're not going to bulk up that quickly and it could be really useful for you.
Yeah, and the only thing I would add to that is, if you are thinking about targeting muscle mass and generating that, is also transferring that over into your climbing, because all well and good, and Ollie will probably have something to say back to me on this, to do lots of directed exercise and weights, but then you may have built the muscle mass, but actually you then actually need to transfer it so it's specific and you can utilize it on your climbing. So don't neglect the climbing as well, and building your strength through climbing-based exercise as well.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good point in terms of thinking about this. Transferring it to climbing is going, what actual climbing are you trying to perform at as well? So there are occasions where people are focused on reducing overall weight for performance, particularly on really small holds. And that's quite a big thing, say here in the UK on limestone, where the holds are really small. Yes, I'm not going to lie that that does make a difference in terms of your weight on that sort of hold, but it's usually to do with skin, which if you get the conditions right, you can get around it quite easily. And also, we know quite a lot of climbers that still perform really well on that. I would say, if you are a heavier climber trying to perform on this sort of terrain, a couple of things to keep in mind is, one, pay a bit more attention to conditions, and two, really work out the movements that you want to do efficiently, so you're not spending too much time and getting too much fatigue or breaking your skin down during a session. And three is, focus a little bit more on recovery between getting on that type of rock, because it is are going to be quite stressful for your fingers. But generally, we don't really see performance being massively limited just by adding on being a bit heavier or having a little bit more muscle mass within like the normal range of most people.
Yeah, and on the flip side of that, Ollie's just talked about, if you do have quite a lot of muscle mass and you are looking to climb on that terrain that's generally relatively vertical and really small holds, which we have a lot of in the UK, if you are of that body type where you are naturally very lean and you don't have much muscle mass, it's also really important to check in with yourself quite regularly in terms of, well, how am I doing performance-wise? Have I noticed a drop in the amount of attempts I can have on a project in a day? Am I feeling quite cold all of the time? What are my eating habits like? Have I got any of my climbing partners who are making suggestions that I might be looking a little too light? And being quite aware of that, I think, because that might be a time to really question, well, do I need to take a step back and think about, actually, it'll be better for my performance to put some more muscle mass on.
Yeah. And once again, if you're going to go somewhere where it's not quite as reliant on the hold size, say anyone bouldering in Fontainebleau or climbing say in Norway, in Flatanger, places like that, it's big and burly, don't worry about your weight so much. It'd be better to have that extra strength in body tension positions and being able to compress than it is worrying about those couple of kilos here or there. Cool. All right, so we'll move on to the next question. Hopefully that's gone into enough detail there. So what can you do to be constructive helping your partner climbing, and what can you learn from them? So this is actually quite a good question from a client of mine, actually, who was talking about climbing with their partner. Obviously, for a lot of people, we're still restricted with who we can climb with at the moment. And it's going to be people, your housemates, or generally your partner. And a lot of people, their partners probably do climb. And so how do you kind of maximize that climbing relationship, as well as keeping a friendly and non-abusive, normal relationship? So how do you keep the sanity there and make sure that you're getting the most out of each other? So I know, so you're not exactly the same height as your partner, so you have very different climbing styles, don't you?
Yeah. We do, yeah. So I think there's almost a foot in difference between us height-wise, and there's a very different sort of discipline specialism, as it were, between myself and my other half. And we've been living in close quarters for, must have been about 8 weeks, wasn't it, in England anyway. So yeah, it's been interesting. We've always had this issue where actually my other half is, you know, considerably better than me at bouldering. Like, his level is a lot higher, except in certain areas. So pockets, we're a lot more closely matched there, and really quite small holds than we are on bigger burly moves. So in terms of how to be constructive in that situation, you can look at it from both angles. So I think things that I think work well if you are in my partner's shoes, so if you have a partner at home or you have housemates with you who perhaps aren't at your level and you want to help them, perhaps you've got a home board or you're looking at trying to create some sort of novel fingerboard ideas and jumping to the fingerboard, etc., is to just do a bit of trial and error and really help them by working out where they might need to work the most or where they struggle. It might be wide moves. I know that's something that I've had an issue with over the years. And also using big holds, big active holds that require a bit of squeeze. And so my partner's, through a process of trial and error, through setting boulders for me over the years, has managed to work out, okay, what kind of moves I'm likely to really struggle at. And then to set those, but also to set them in a way which isn't really so hard that I can't even do any of them. But that does take time. So I think it's being quite patient with each other in that situation and saying, oh, actually, that problem you've set is really, really tough. I can't even do that move. And it's learning from that and adapting to it. But it does take some time. And then on the reverse side, for me, it's recognizing, well, what moves does my other half struggle with, and what are his strong points? And again, you can do it both ways. So I can set problems for him or suggest alternatives that push him. So I think you can create that nice kind of symbiotic relationship, but it does take that bit of time. And I think that little bit of patience, and it works really well now, because we know exactly how to push each other. But there will be moments, you know, when, you know, you might have an off day and you set a really bad problem and it gets, you know, it's a bit tense. But I think that's really useful. That's in the context of setting problems and stuff. And then there's the whole issue of what you can learn from them when you watch them outside. I don't know whether you want to talk about that a bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been an intense period, hasn't it? Like 8 weeks now together. in a house or in a closed vicinity. But so for me, one of the biggest things is, and without going too much into kind of Oprah Winfrey style of relationship advice, is I find it really interesting that partners or housemates don't communicate as climbers. And you might know each other really, really well, and you spend so much time together and you understand each other's personalities, but there's a lot of different changes in personality in sport, and understanding the person as a climber makes a big difference. So just ask them what works for you in terms of comments and stuff like, okay, you're having a really bad day and I can see that you're doing really badly. What would you like me to do in that circumstance? I think that just speeds up that process, getting to know each other, getting to know each other's problems. And like Ella said, sometimes your partner or yourself, you set a really bad problem or they set a bad problem for you and it's just miles off and you're already having a bad session. And in that circumstance, it's quite easy sometimes to, for them to say something exactly wrong for you, or you say the bad wrong thing and you just thought, oh God, I've ruined their session now, and it's just demotivated them. So just ask the question at the start, go, if you're having a bad day, do you prefer me just to ask or say you're doing all right, or remind you, or do you want me just to leave you to it? And then same thing again, if they're having a really good day and they're pushing too hard and they just want to keep going and going and going, which is a problem I've always had at the moment, is being able to tell someone, okay, you should probably stop now because I reckon you're going to get injured. And it's doing that in the right way without sort of trying to, once again, demotivate them or take away from the session, and just making sure that you've got that level of communication from the start sorted. And I think that makes a massive difference to speeding up. So just ask those questions, because I see it a little bit like the same with belaying outside, particularly when you're starting to go back outside at the moment, is if someone's seems a little bit nervous, is rather than them just kind of getting on with it and getting frustrated with their belay because they taught someone else at the bottom, or they don't feel like they're paying attention as much, is just tell the person straight away and say, look, I'm quite nervous. It makes a big deal to me if you talk to anyone else at the bottom, or if I'm like high above a bolt, I like certain things to be said or not said. So like it makes a big difference in that circumstance, but it also does in the element of training. So I think in both those elements, just have that communication pathway open from the very beginning. Because I think, like you say, if you're trying to set problems for someone else, it can be quite hard, can't it, when it's not going right. And I think there's the other side of this, is what can you actually learn in that circumstance? So what can you learn from climbing with someone who's very, very different from you? Because we're very similar, aren't we, in terms of our partners are much more endurance-based and we're more strength-based.
Yeah.
And I'd say the same thing is I'm a lot used to, more used to popping to holds and doing more sort of dynamic movements, which I know my partner's really learned from, and then vice versa. As soon as it becomes about hanging in there and actually coping with pump, I've definitely learned a lot from her. So I think spending that time to work out what they're good at and what can I learn from that's a big thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think tactics as well, because as you rightly pointed out, you know, I think we've got a bit more of a bouldering background compared to our partners, or at least that's been our focus a little bit more, despite the fact that we are still route climbers. But it's really useful to look to your partner and see, well, how do they climb when I'm belaying them? You know, are they sitting on their feet a lot more? Are they getting into rest positions that look a lot more comfortable? Are they relaxed more on the holds? Do they have a particular way of clipping, or when they're stopping and they're analysing what they're doing? You can ask them afterwards how they approach that section on the route, if you've done the same route, because it's really interesting to glean A, how they think and how they've approached it, and then B, just watch them as well and work out what you can take from that will help you. You know, for example, for me, my partner is excellent at high stepping. So he can get himself out of danger in a really difficult situation really quickly, because he's got really good flexibility in that high step range, definitely not in the bridge range. It's a bit of an ongoing joke, but that's something that's one of his strengths. So for me, during the lockdown, I've been working a lot on trying to develop that. So, and that's what I've learned from climbing with him so much.
But we do want to just say to be careful. If any of this advice causes any arguments, we do not take the blame between an unhappy household. So take the, that bit of advice at your own own risk. Okay, so a couple of quicker ones now, because I think they were quite in deep, was what is our favourite drink at the Crag? And this one I've kind of chosen actually from a little bit of recent experience, and quite a good point that was brought up with me is sort of caffeine at the Crag in particular is what I was thinking of. So having, well, first of all, what's your favourite drink at the Crag?
Well, mine has to be black coffee, but I've got a very high tolerance level for caffeine. I've gone out in the last few days outside and I've realised I've had an espresso when I've woken up. I've then had a coffee in the car on the way to the Crag, and then I've had a flask of coffee at the Crag, and actually I haven't noticed any ill effects. So I'm obviously a bit, yeah, a bit tolerant, probably too tolerant.
Yeah. See, I would say that I probably have the same affinity for coffee, but I've definitely made the problem at the moment is I've been sitting at home working a lot and drinking tea and coffee throughout the day. And then I've started going back outside again, and I've lost all sort of ability to plan my bag in the morning and getting food and coffee ready. So I've been getting there and going, oh, I don't know why I feel a bit tired, and I've eaten enough, but I'm feeling a little bit like I'm lagging. And I realized I've gone from probably having a similar amount of caffeine throughout the day. And then my favorite drink as well would be just white coffee, but then not taking anything with me. And that really knocked off the edge when I'm at the Crag. So I'd say in terms of, well, our favourite drinks are coffee as well, but if you are used to drinking throughout the day caffeine, yeah, keep doing it whilst you're at the Crag, because even if it's something that you're not particularly aware that it makes a difference to your performance, if it's different from day-to-day living, it might not make you perform better, but it might make you perform worse if you don't have it.
Yeah.
So just something a little bit extra to keep in mind there when you're actually planning what you're going to take to the Crag with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you did what I did, and I've been lucky, I got away with it, but I could very, and I've had this experience in the past where I've just had too much coffee in too short a period of time, and I've got sort of what's felt like quite bad palpitations, and I've felt quite sweaty from it, which has affected my performance at the Crag. So I think also just being mindful of not condensing all of your intake into a short window of time.
So along those lines, we had another question about if you're doing an early start, because a lot of people are trying to drive in one day to go and visit somewhere to go climbing and back, because obviously staying away at the moment in a lot of places, a lot of countries is restricted. So what do we recommend regarding an early start and planning our food and our warm-ups and our schedule throughout the day? And this is a great question actually to have today, because I know Ella's quite an organized person, and myself and Tom would not fall into that category, or could not see the line of organization generally. So this is a good one for Ella to help me out with. So I know you've been up to Malham quite a lot, which is around 2 hours drive away. Mm. What's kind of like your general day looking like?
Yeah. So that's quite a long drive. I mean, we're not going there at the moment, but we are getting up super early. So there's a lot of planning that goes into our climbing days, as you might expect. So planning is key. So night before, generally, we plan out what we're going to eat during the day, and then we create it so that we don't have to do it in a rush in the morning, particularly if we're setting off early, which you would be if you've got to drive a few hours for a Crag. I think those of you based in the US, you do some absolutely mega drives, which I'm always really impressed with, where you're going to set off really early or you're going to drive through the night. And I think in that situation, I don't see why you wouldn't plan quite meticulously, and Tupperware, and having lots of things and snacks prepared. So if getting up early is the key, some people really don't want to eat straight away. I always like to try and eat something, even if it's only a small snack, like a banana and an egg or something really small like that, just to tide you over, because you've got up, your stomach hasn't had any food for however long you've slept. So just to get things moving. And then whilst I'm on the journey, if I'm not driving, then I will eat a little something. So usually it's that when working out for me, when is that sort of half an hour to an hour before I'm likely to start warming up? Because I think that's a really important time to start having some carbs and some protein, so that when you actually get to the Crag and you start warming up, you feel that you're fueled. Because I think one of the mistakes that I've made in the past is not eating something at all, rocking up to warm up and just feeling like I'm running on fumes. And I think that's the worst situation. It's almost too late then, because then you start ploughing in the food and it doesn't come through quick enough. So I think it's about having those snacks available so that you can have an energy feed throughout the day, and not having it too late, but also not having it too early. How have you approached your snacking?
Oh, I would say, like I said before, I'm not the best at planning in advance, but I think one of the best lessons I've learned is, because I don't like eating early in the morning, I'm not a morning person, but I will get up early to go cragging somewhere else, or at the moment just so I get a quiet place to go. So for me, it'd be starting to drive and then just forcing a rest stop to eat something and have a drink. And I'm very much, once my mind's on something, I'll get pretty overly psyched, so I'll really struggle to just do stuff slowly. So pulling over and just forcing a rest in terms of like just eating some food, like you say, having it prepped is really important for me. And then when you're at the car and you've pulled up and you've got a bit of a walk in, because once again, forcing yourself that you've got something prepared and you have to finish that before you get your bag and go out to the crag. Because once again, normally if I don't do this, I will drive there and I'll think, oh, it'll be all right, I'll eat when I arrive. And then I'll get there, I'll be too psyched, and I'll grab my bag and I'll walk to the crag. And then the last thing I want to do is not get on the climb straight away. So I'll get on climbing and then I've already done a warm up before I've eaten. So yeah, just adding in those set points, which is probably the most organized thing I've ever done. And then just slowing everything down just a little bit makes a big difference, because it means I can last so much longer. I'll get more climbing done and it's better for me in the long run.
Yeah, and I think when you're actually there climbing as well, it's remembering to make sure that you do hydrate, you know, in between your goes on your climbs, and just having little snacks, you know, every hour or so is something that I think works quite well. Because I think as soon as you start to feel that empty stomach and you start to feel that, oh, I'm actually quite hungry, then you've got to go and eat something and then you've got to wait for it to come through. So I think a degree of planning is actually really helpful for making sure you get the most out of your day.
Yeah, and I think if you're doing that well, then it builds into your warm-up as well, because if you feel relaxed, you've eaten and you're doing everything on sort of a bit of a schedule, even in your mind, you don't have to be too strict, but that'll transfer to your warm-ups. You'll probably take a bit more care with those and you'll be a little bit more thoughtful and reserved, rather than rushing around and then getting on the harder stuff too soon. So those warm-ups, once again, you generally try and have a routine going into that. And for me, if it's an early start, once again, I have to do quite a bit more than normal, and I definitely 100% have to take a portable fingerboard if it's an early start, because I do not like pulling onto holds when it's cold and I've barely been awake for many hours, and it's something that really bothers me. And so if I just warm up on a fingerboard a bit more and a bit of jogging around, a bit more cardio than normal, makes a big difference compared to what I would normally do later on in the day.
Yeah, completely. And then likewise, if you've got a long journey home, I think it's either useful to have, again, those snacks already pre-prepared, or know those spots on the way back where you can pick up food. Because I think on the way back from Malham, there are some very particular spots that we like to drop off at and get some food. Because if we're getting back really late, we don't want to eat a load of food just before going to bed. So yeah, that's typically what we do.
Cool. So hopefully you found that quite interesting again. We're going to release some more episodes in the next couple of weeks, so make sure to like and subscribe, and we'll both see you very soon.
Cheers.